That's fantastic, Steve Paulette. Well, I'm joined now by my favorite baseball writer, the great Bob Clappish. Bob, thanks so much for getting up early to be with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's an honor and a throwback to another time in my life when we were both college kids.
You know, I was lucky enough to have a mom who called me one day from Florida while I was living here in Los Angeles and said, Robbie, I just found a shoebox filled with your old baseball cards. What do you want me to do with them? I go, most mothers threw them in the garbage. Oh, my God, you still have all my baseball cards. I have every single card in the 1968 Top Series. I remember vividly waiting the last day of school, getting the last card. And she said, what do you want? I said, send them to me. She sent them to me. So I have Nolan Ryan's rookie card. But the reason I'm telling you this story, Bob Clappish, is because in 1968, in that set that I have, is Roberto Clemente. Okay? In 1968, my Topps baseball card does not say his name is Roberto. He is on my Topps baseball card as Bob Clemente. Yeah, can you imagine?
Right. That's right. No, I mean, I knew that way back. I mean, I've known it.
You especially have to know it because you're Roberto Clappish. You're not Bob Clappish. You're Bob Clappish, but you're Roberto Clappish, right?
Depends who I'm writing for. My real name is Roberto. My mother was Brazilian.
Wow.
And grew up speaking Portuguese in the house. And wow. Now there's a website. And beyond the New York Times, in addition to the New York Times, I also write for a website called La Vida Baseball, which is for all matters about the Spanish-speaking and Hispanic Latino world in baseball. There I am, Roberto Salvador Clappish.
That's unbelievable. Well, right. I used to get some of your mail. Fortunately, it wasn't important, so I would throw it away. But you may have even gotten some of my mail when we were in college.
It's sort of like an alternate universe to be talking to Robbie Clappish. That's my nickname. That's what people call me. My buddy's Clapper. So I'm talking to Robbie. Bob Clappish is talking to Robbie Clappish.
This is the best. And in our yearbook, because it's our 40th reunion, I'm not going to be able to make it to the reunion, but in our yearbook that we have, there's a picture that I've looked at for 40 years of you on the pitcher's mound.
Yeah.
Right? You remember this?
Yes, of course.
You were the star of the yearbook, which is incredible.
That is pretty funny. And I'm still playing baseball, too.
And you're still playing. Any injuries? Anything I have to operate on?
No. Well, you know, a little osteoarthritis in the knee, a little hip impingement, but, you know, still out there. A couple of Advil and I'm fine.
I used to schlep, because I was on the crew team my freshman year, lightweight crew, with the subway to Bakersfield to go to the boathouse. You also had to take the subway all the way uptown to get to the baseball field, right?
That is correct.
Oh, my God.
That's back then. I just was up at the Bakersfield 2 weeks ago to talk about my book during a Columbia baseball game, and their broadcast on ESPN. So it was really brought back some memories. And believe me, it doesn't look anything like what we remember.
I know. It's a different world. It's a different universe with the technology that we have now. Do you wrote for Spectator, right?
I did. I was a sports editor, the Columbia Spectator.
So I was a cartoonist for Spectator until they threw me off the paper because I drew a cartoon of a helicopter lowering a giant yarmulke on top of Low Library. And I had two guys at the bottom of the cartoon that one said to the other, but I thought you said your donation had no strings attached. They said, Clapper, this is anti-Semitic. We can't run it in the paper. I said, I'm Jewish. How can I be anti-Semitic? That was it. We're done with you, Clapper. Get out of here. Who was the editor of the newspaper? He lives in Farillo. He's actually out here. He does something with CBS, I think. So... I'm fascinated.
Joe Farullo, that's right.
Joe Farullo. I'm fascinated, and I built the whole show about you, if you've been listening, or you can listen to the podcast, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You've picked a sport. What is so special to the layperson that would touch your heart so deeply? My dad was a carpenter. My mother was a nurse. What touched my heart deeply was to be a surgeon and be a carpenter in the body, so I became an orthopedic surgeon. What touched your heart so deeply that you said, it's baseball? That's what I want to devote my life to.
Well, I think it picked me. I mean, baseball, I always had this incredible innate talent for throwing a baseball. As long as I can remember, my dad was my Little League coach. I was always a pitcher. And there's two things that I always have done very well in my life, which was to write creatively, and to throw a baseball, play baseball. Honestly, you know, if I wasn't an all-county player in high school, I probably wouldn't have gotten into Columbia. It certainly helped. But I have been able to merge my two passions in life, which is to write and baseball. And now I'm a sports writer writing about the Mets and Yankees. Like, you know, it's been a dream come true. I've been able to stay around baseball, organized baseball, Major League Baseball, for 30 years. And, you know, I couldn't imagine doing anything else in my life.
Bob Klapsch, I want to play a soundbite. For me, it's like having Michelangelo on the telephone right now asking him about art. This is what's great about having you, because one of my professors in surgery, his name is Ranawat, he invented the knee replacement. He used to say, the eyes don't see what the mind doesn't know. I want you, as a baseball writer for all these years, and as great as you are, my ears don't hear what my mind doesn't know. What is it that Bob Klapsch hears in this soundbite?
Now he's ready. Fastball high, ball two. You can't blame a man for pushing just a little bit now. Sandy backs off, mops his forehead, runs his left index finger along his forehead, dries it off on his left pants leg. All the while, Keene just waiting. Now Sandy looks in. Into his windup, and the 2-1 pitch to Keene. Swung on and missed. Strike two. It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
My ears don't hear what my mind doesn't know. What do you hear when you hear that?
Well, I mean, the hairs on my arm are standing up. To a young Vin Scully talking about Sandy Koufax, my God, that's great. I mean, the imagery, you know, I can just visualize it. You know, I'm there at the moment. It's alive. And that's what I try to do as a writer. Scully was so good at broadcasting live play-by-play, is to bring the reader into the moment, to either put him in the pitcher's on the pitcher's mound or in the batter's box, and let him feel and hear and smell and sense everything that's going on. And in that sense, I've always had an advantage over other writers, because I've been on the mound, and I, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100, me compared to Sandy Koufax, I'm a negative value. But I've done that. I mean, everything he's done, I've done, and I know what it's like to give up a home run in the ninth inning or to strike out someone in the ninth inning. Obviously on a much, much different level. But I'm able to capture those moments the way Vin did. Oh, my God, listen to him. I'm telling you, I just got chills. I love him. I mean, he's the greatest. But I do that as a writer. And that's why sports is so much fun, because of the drama. Every day there's something on that field, on that basketball court, or on the gridiron that captures, you know, human competition, man against man. I mean, there's no filter there. It is just pure competition. And to capture it, whether in writing or speaking and describing it, to me, is just, it's pure art.
LeBron is not just a great basketball player. He's an artist with the basketball. Same for Kobe Bryant. Same for Michael Jordan. I think if you're a plumber, you're an electrician, you're an IT guy, whatever you want to do with your life, you want to be a surgeon, the highest compliment you can give someone is they're not only good at that profession, but they're an artist at it. That's what you're talking about. That's the answer, really, you gave to my question, is you bring the art, the painting, the pictures, the words I view that Chick Hearn used to say, to how much do you attribute, let's just like baseball picked you. You could have gone to another school, but because they took me by the ear and made me take art history, I'm a kid from the streets of New York. I've never been to a museum before. They made me study art history, and trust me, I have patents. I've developed instruments used all over the world. All the things that I do as a doctor, being on the radio right now, painting pictures, is artistic. How did that, how did Columbia, in the sense, and I'm not trying to pitch Columbia, but take me back to the art classes that you took, where you got inspired, or who is the writer that inspired you in your career?
Wow, that's a really deep question. Well, first of all, just talking about the educational experience at Columbia, as you said, it made you think, and it forced you to be exposed to different curriculum that you would never have done at a different school or a state school. It made me take art humanities and literature humanities and read books that I probably would have never read, or think about art history in a way that I never would have. And I'm surrounded by students who I would have never been surrounded by. You know, I grew up in Leonia, New Jersey, and suddenly I'm going to school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Whole different world. For better or for worse, it just trained me to think in a way that I never had. And I ended up living in the city for about 15 years after I graduated on the Upper West Side because I loved it so much.
Mm-hmm.
It just made me see things and hear things in the world around me that I would not have in northern New Jersey.
Mm.
And, you know, the school was without parallel, without comparison. Just the brilliance of the students, the ambition and the drive and the vision that most of these kids have, and the teachers. Just the whole atmosphere on campus, and I'm obviously not telling you anything you don't know or don't remember, but there is something unique about Columbia that even the other Ivies could not match. I'm talking about Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. You're in New York City, and it was a phenomenal experience, for better or for worse. I mean, I saw things in New York that I never dreamed of. I will tell you a story. On my first day of fall practice, going up to Baker Field, I mean, first of all, taking a subway to baseball practice is something I never had to do. You know, coming from Bergen County, New Jersey, I'm suddenly on the number one in the middle of the afternoon. And this is the 70s. This is, you know, the late 70s. New York was not a pretty place.
Right.
It was not a particularly safe place at the time.
Right.
There were two eras of New York which were really, really, you know, sort of dark and violent, which was the late 70s and also the early 90s, and I was there for both.
Mm-hmm.
But here I am on my first day going to fall practice, and it was a sort of a sleepy afternoon, and you know, if you remember, the subway would go over elevated track,
mm-hmm.
125th Street, so we're really, really slow at that point, which the train had to do. And there was like five or six kids playing the music really, really, really loud on one of those old-fashioned boom boxes, which you know, looked like the size of a bread box. And there was six or seven elderly people pretending to be asleep. They were annoyed. It was a nuisance. It was really offensive and rude. And these kids had basically taken over the subway car, and they're looking at me like, what are you going to do about it? The music was too loud. What are you going to do? And, you know, me, nothing. I looked away. I was outnumbered. The old folks were sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, a transit cop pops onto the car, walking through. And I'm telling you, he looked like Sylvester Stallone, built like Stallone, but he was 6'4". You know, he was like this. He was like Michelangelo's David. He walks up to the kid with the boombox, and he says, turn that bleep off now. And the kid looks at him, stands up, looks back at his friends, and he takes the cop's hat, and he flings it down the length of the subway car. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on here? Cop, I'm telling you, and this could never happen today, the cop winds up and punches the kid in the face so fast that the kid was unconscious by the time he hit the ground.
Oh, my God.
He pulls out his gun, his .38, and he points it at the next kid's head, now said, now which one of you wants to mess with me next? And he didn't use the word mess. Which one of you's next? Now suddenly, all these old people who had been pretending to be asleep spring to life and say, shoot him! Shoot them all! Shoot them all! We won't say nothing! Shoot them all! And I'm saying, oh, my God, this is Columbia. This is the Wild West. Now these kids who had been such tough guys 30 seconds before were crying like babies. No, no, please. They were like blubbering. The saliva's like flowing out of their mouth. No! Cop gets on his radio. He calls ahead. We pull into the 125th Street station, and 20 cops pour onto the car and drag these kids off.
Wow.
And these old people are still taunting these kids. Yeah, you just learned a lesson, boy. Go ahead, officers. Take them up, beat them up, mess them up. We won't see nothing. That was my introduction to Columbia baseball, and life on the New York City subway system on day one.
That's fantastic. All right. Before I ask you who's your favorite baseball player and why, mine was Mickey Mantle. Orthopedically, something fascinating maybe that you know or don't know about Mickey Mantle, but when he was 8, he suffered an open fracture of his tibia and got an infection in his bone, which is called osteomyelitis, which is nasty. If you ever get, you get an infection in your skin, your muscle, okay. But when you get bacteria into your bone, it's all, it's next level, because the bugs can hibernate in the bone. It's very difficult to eradicate it. But when he got this osteomyelitis in Oklahoma at 8 years old, there's no antibiotics. You would die from sepsis. You'd lose your leg. All the horrible things would take place. Mickey Mantle's father knew that penicillin was started and was helping war veterans after World War II. But you can, you're not getting penicillin in during the war years in Oklahoma. It's going all for the guys fighting overseas. But Mickey Mantle's dad knew that there was a doctor in Oklahoma. Get a load of this. You're not going to believe this, Bob Clappish. Who was saving the urine of the vets that came back from World War II. Because once you've been given the penicillin, it still exists even if you pee it in your urine. And he was collecting their urine, isolating the penicillin. And because you couldn't get penicillin any other way, he was getting penicillin by getting it, by concentrating it out of the urine of the veterans. And put Mickey Mantle in the family truck and drove to wherever in Oklahoma to this doctor and got penicillin first and saved Mickey Mantle's leg so that he could be ultimately become the Mickey Mantle we know. Did you know that story?
I had no idea. That's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Mickey Mantle's dad saved his son's leg and life by doing that. Great story. Who, as if it's impossible to give an answer, but growing up, who was your favorite player and why?
Well, growing up, as a kid, I was a Mets fan, and I would have to say Tom Seaver.
Wow.
Just because he was so great. And it's just so heartbreaking, you know, what's happening with him now.
Yeah.
You know, with the extreme dementia that he's mm-hmm. suffering with, and he basically is all but retired from public life. It's become that bad. You know, I end up meeting Seaver. And,
wow.
You know, covered him, you know, the second go-around with the Mets. And it was weird. Very early in my career, I was meeting some of the players that I had rooted for growing up, and Seaver was one of them. And he was actually not that great of a guy. I mean, he was actually pretty aloof and pretty arrogant, especially with a young writer like me. But he was just so great, and just what a precision, a combination of precision pitching and velocity and tough, and he was smart. He was an ex-Marine, and I mean, he was everything that you would want in a ball player. You'd want, that's the kind of guy you'd want on a mound in Game 7. And Seaver had all of that. You know, he was emotionally equipped to be a leader, physically, in terms of pure skill. I mean, he was above and beyond. You know, as a Met fan, I root for it. I rooted for him. I love watching him pitch. And, you know, I still have great, great memories of just turning on this TV, Channel 9, WOR, Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, Bob Kiner, all of whom, of course, I met, not Lindsey, but Bob and Ralph. Ended up meeting them and seeing them all the time at Shea Stadium. But, you know, that brings me back to being growing up in Leonia, New Jersey, and being a Mets fan.
Wow. How about Phil Rizzuto? You ever meet him?
Oh, of course. I mean, Phil was quite a character. I mean, you know, he was everything that you'd ever heard about him or read about him, the caricature of him, was true. That was him. There was nothing fake about him. That was not his. There was not an off-air personality of Phil Rizzuto. That was him 24/7. Funny, never took himself seriously, really was on the George Washington Bridge by the eighth inning, never stayed for the whole game because he wanted to beat the traffic. obviously an announcer like that would not translate into today's game. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously so much more serious, and mm-hmm. there's so much information, so much more data that's required of an analyst.
Mm-hmm.
But he was there to tell stories and to make viewers remember, you know, baseball's a game, and he came from a different era in the game, and he was great for that generation, and I love the man.
Last night we got to watch Steph Curry be Steph Curry, and I was watching it with some friends, and I reminded them that Steph Curry trains in a way, he recognizes that shooting that quickly, once the ball gets in his hand so the defender doesn't have a chance, is because he understands something that neurosurgeons understand, which is cerebrum versus cerebellum. You're not thinking to breathe. You're not thinking to walk. That comes from your brainstem and your cerebellum, not from conscious thought. That's why Steph Curry goes to the gym, shuts all the lights out, it's pitch black, and has a strobe light that blinks, and he uses that instant. He's literally trying to train his cerebellum to make his shot a reflex, not a thought, okay? My favorite Yogi Berra story is that apparently, tell me if this is true, Yogi Berra was in a slump and terrible. And he's got more RBIs in like playoff games than anybody else. I mean, he's like the greatest baseball player. He and Willie Mays are probably the greatest ever. You'll have to tell me if you agree. But Yogi Berra was in a slump and the Yankees got him a sports psychologist to work on him, to make him a better hitter. And apparently, after striking out 40 times in a row or whatever it was, he goes up for the 41st time and three strikes, he's out. And Yogi Berra apparently goes back to the dugout, throws his bat, and says, "You can't think and hit at the same time."
And that's true. I mean, everything that you just described about Curry, and I watched that game last night, everything you just said is true. And the greatest ball players I've ever met are the ones who don't think and just react and just compete, which makes it even more remarkable that someone like Alex Rodriguez could have been as great as he was. Okay, I know what you're going to say. Probably all of it was fueled by steroids.
No, no.
But I have never met a player, a great player, who is so neurotic and so caught up in his own thought process in the middle of an at-bat than him. And the other end of the spectrum is Derek Jeter, who is just this actually one-dimensional, so focused on competing and hitting and rising to the moment. Nothing else entered his thought process. There was no internal monologue for Derek. He just went up there and he knew what he had to do and did it, whereas Alex went through every checklist, swing, weight shift, follow through, you know, studying the pitcher, thinking about himself, reanalyzing the last pitch as the next one is coming, and that would just gum up the works. The fact that he was able to be so great spoke to his talent, but ultimately, Yogi was right. You simply have to turn off that mechanism and react on instinct.
I have one last question because I could talk to you for hours. It's just such a pleasure to talk to the great Bob Clappish. The Lakers currently are in desperate need of a coach. What's the value of a manager in baseball? Can they bring out the best in a player? How do they interact? Who does it the best? Is it a Phil Jackson approach? Is it more of a noisy guy's approach? What is it, Davey Johnson? You know, who is it that you saw do it the best and why?
There's no short answer to that. It's a great question, just that there's no short answer. It depends on the sport. Baseball managers are in a different category altogether because it's a six-month sport. There's interaction 6 hours a day, 150 days a year. So you can't manage from an arm's length. You have to have a relationship with your players in that room. To me, a baseball manager does his best work before and after every game. The strategy is no longer part of the job description, whereas in the past, managers were lauded for their gut instincts and playing on a hunch in terms of when to call a hit and run or when to bring in a certain relief pitcher. That's all been figured out now by advanced analytics. There are literally 25 people upstairs in front of their computers running software programs that will run through every situation in a game and figure out the probability of success.
Wow.
So everything a manager has to decide on has already been decided and has basically been relayed to him, say, you need to put in relief pitcher B instead of A, and you can call the hit and run with this guy instead of that guy. So that part of the game has been figured out. It's been actually taken out of a manager's hands. What he has to do is commune with his players in a way to get them to maximize their talent, to get that extra gear out of them. Now, it used to be that managers were these real hard-bitten, hard, old-time SOBs. I'm talking about the Earl Weavers and the Billy Martins and the Whitey Herzogs, who were horrible to cover. I mean, really bad, bad, bad people. And they were fueled by negative energy. Players hated them, but they played better because they hated them.
Got it.
But today, it's completely different. Players are much more sensitive to that kind of feedback and do not react to criticism. They don't want to be talked about negatively in the press, which is why Joe Girardi ended up losing his job, which is why Earl Reaver and even Davey Johnson, which is why Earl Reaver and Billy Martin wouldn't last a week in today's environment. You need a manager who the players like and buy into and trust and respect, which is why Alex Cora was so successful with the Red Sox last year, because the players believed him. Every crazy move he made during the postseason worked because the players said to themselves, this guy knows his stuff. And if he's calling for this move or this crazy relief decision for a relief pitcher, it's because he's got it figured out. Don't have to worry about it. He's right. And it worked. Everything clicked for the Red Sox. And a manager has to have that level of cooperation, understanding, and respect that it did not exist 50 years ago. It does now. So, which is why the Yankees have Aaron Boone in the clubhouse after never having managed a game in his life. But he has great communication skills. And that's the number one priority in hiring a manager today.
It's the only sport, by the way, where the coach is wearing a uniform like the player.
That's right. And that speaks to
the bonding,
the unity of a team and roster in the clubhouse. He's one of them.
All right. Before I let you go, what book do we need to read? What are you up to next? How can we follow you? All
you
those things.
The book I just wrote with New York Times bestseller called Inside the Empire about the Yankees. And it's basically a look behind the curtain on how the Yankees do business. And it's the best book I've ever written. Number six in my career, Inside the Empire. Nice.
Bob Klapisch, you're the brother I have from another mother. I can't thank you enough. I cannot wait to have dinner with you and meet you in person finally, but this is the perfect first step. God bless you.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
All right. What a pleasure to talk to you as well. Warriors, the great Bob Klapisch, go get that book, The Inside the Empire. Wow. I can't wait to get it. Thanks so much again, Bob, for joining us. Appreciate it. Coming up next, we've got to finish up. Not a lot of time left. I may have to tell a story. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. This is a shock. Let's go to Mark from Canner's Deli. Mark, thanks for calling in.
How you doing?
Do you actually, are you related to the owners of Canner's Deli?
Yeah, I'm third generation. My grandfather was the founder. And we're actually at fourth generation. My son and my cousins are involved. So,
were you there when Obama came?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, my God. Did he eat at the deli?
They did. He did. What happened was he was just supposed to have coffee and a tea and some arugula, and it was a meeting to meet some people that wrote in questions. And he actually wanted to eat, off the menu, but he had a lunch to go to, an hour later with some ambassador or something. And so they said he would only be eating light. But, of course, my brother Gary snuck him a pastrami sandwich, and he took it to go.
That's because his doctor gave him a prescription that said one pastrami sandwich would make him feel better. He'll solve world peace, Mark Canner, with a Cantor's pastrami sandwich.
No matter what the doctor says, you can still have a pastrami sandwich.
Can I ask you a question so that I can tell my wife, who I hope is not listening?
Sure.
The ceiling in the dining room is one of the greatest ceilings of any dining room I've ever been in. Believe me, the White House doesn't have a ceiling this fantastic to eat under than the ceiling in the Canter's Deli, because it looks like you're in a forest where the leaves are changing, right?
Right.
Is it plastic or is it stained glass?
Well, okay, I hate to break it to you, but it's a
forest. Damn!
Your wife is on the line, Doc. Your wife is on the line.
Let me tell you something.
It was put in 1983. If it would have been put in back in the 50s, it would have been stained glass.
Okay. You know what? You're such an honest man. We love you, Mark. And I love your deli. And I love the kreplach. And the chicken broth is... I eat the chicken soup at all the delis. And I don't need to name all of them. Everybody knows from Art's and Brent's and Jerry's. And yours is the most flavorful chicken soup I've had in Los Angeles.
Well, we make it with love.
Yeah, exactly right. All right. Do you have an orthopedic problem I can help you with?
I do.
Good. I'm trading you an orthopedic exam for a pastrami sandwich. This is how life should be. This will be the new HMO.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. Do you like a pastrami sandwich or you like the Reuben?
Oh, I love the Reuben. Are you kidding?
The pastrami sandwich has its own right, but the Reuben, it takes you to another level.
It does.
Your eyes will spin like a...
You know what? And I'll tell you what's also great. Your coleslaw. It's an art form to make coleslaw properly. You have the creaminess, you have the vinegar, you have the sugar in it, you have the right amount of carrots in it, and it's been marinating for a while. There's something special about your coleslaw.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so back to my shoulder.
Back to your shoulder. Okay. I'm getting a free sandwich. You can now have your shoulder evaluated. Go ahead.
Somebody actually literally bumped into me while they were walking and kind of tore my shoulder about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And right away I knew that it was a problem because it hurt really bad instantly.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured, okay, we'll see what happens in a couple weeks. It might go away. In the end, it didn't go away.
Question, Mark. Mark, do you have diabetes?
No.
Because people with diabetes get frozen shoulders that are really tough to treat. So that's a good news. Okay, keep going.
So anyways, I went for an MRI, and it showed that I had a little tear in there.
Good.
And then they said it would heal. There's really nothing to do surgically.
They sent you to therapy.
But they made a mistake. Yeah, they did send me to therapy, but I made a mistake by getting the cortisone shot.
Oh!
And I know this because it wasn't the cortisone that got me. It was the needle passing through to get to the through the muscle to get to the shoulder, which actually did more damage than the to my, because then it hurt worse.
Right.
And the doctor said it's going to hurt for about a week, but it hurt worse for, you know, like 3 more months.
Correct.
So eventually physical therapy, and they were trying to strengthen it and do some things. But for whatever reason, I ended up getting frozen shoulder. I guess that I wasn't using it because my body was protecting it. Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to therapy for the frozen shoulder, and I'm doing some working out at home with a 2-pound weight a little bit and moving it and stretching it. I'm getting more movement now.
Good. Good.
With that goadiometer or whatever they use, I can get to, after a good stretch, I can get to 145. So I guess you're supposed to get to 180.
Right. Well, this is what you're supposed to get to, your other shoulder. Just look in the mirror. That's the goal. You want to duplicate what you have on the good shoulder.
So, but I'm not really taking Advil or anything, which I don't know. So I don't really know.
So let me give you some advice. You ready?
Yeah.
Being Jewish, you're incapable of putting a pulley into a beam in the ceiling of the garage and passing some clothesline and making handles. So I won't even go there of you going to the hardware store to doing that. So this is the Jewish version of making a pulley for Mark Cantor. You're going to take the belt off your bathrobe, throw it over the top of the closet door, and you're going to now use that as a pulley for just a few minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, five times a day. You cannot look at the success here, Mark Cantor, as I'm going to therapy 3 days a week for an hour for them to work on me. It ain't going to work. You have to marinate your shoulder like that coleslaw of yours. You're going to need to talk to it with range of motion exercises for just a few minutes, but constantly. This is the cooking that you're going to have to do. The pastrami smells good at 10 minutes. It takes 2 hours to cook. You're not cooked yet, okay? Did I give enough delicatessen clapper visions for you?
You did, but something you don't know is I do all the refrigeration, plumbing, and electrical for the last 30 years. So I can go to the hardware store.
Okay, good. Make a pulley.
It's frustrating when you're trying to fix something and you don't have the other shoulder. It's very frustrating.
Yeah,
so
no.
Gotta get it back.
Listen, if it doesn't get better, then you and I need to talk some more. All right, Mark Cantor?
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in. Only in Los Angeles can you talk about a deli and the guy who owns it calls. What a great show this is. I'm exhausted already, and I'm hungry. Oh, my God. What kind of a song is this? Pancake rap. That's fantastic. Leave it to you, Steve Paulette, to find this. So, you're listening to ESPN, and I know there's Fox, and we know all HBO has sports. But let me tell you something. I'm going to tell you about a show I want you all to watch on Netflix called Fastball. I don't care if you like baseball or not, and your wife may not care about sports. Make her sit down with you to watch this show, because it's one of the greatest documentaries I've ever seen. And it has nothing to do with the topic, even. It's just how well it's put together. It's kind of like one of those Ken Burns things where, like, they just get it. They just do it great. But there is a line in there by the pitcher, the great Bob Gibson, one of the greatest pitchers, most intimidating pitcher, because if he didn't like you, he threw right at your head. Home plate was his property, basically. And he says one thing in the show that is so inspiring. And he says, in life, when you get good at something, it's a wonderful life. And what it does is it takes the pressure off you that you don't have to be the best. You just need to get good at something, whatever it is. Then you have a wonderful life. It's just a great, it's called Fastball. Don't miss it. All right, let's take some calls. I'm on a roll here. Let's go to Tom in Santa Monica. You're on with Dr. Clapper. How can I help?
Hello.
Hi, Tom. What do you do for a living?
How are you? I'm an electrician.
Have you ever been shocked?
Yeah.
Now I know you're an electrician. Because if you said no, you're not an electrician. Because if an electrician tells the truth, every one of them has been shocked. I like thrown across the room sometimes.
That's happened.
That's right. You really are an electrician. What does your dad do for a living?
My dad, what does he do?
Or what did he do? Was he an electrician too?
No.
So you picked this up all by yourself?
My older brother and, yeah.
Wow.
Also a surfer.
You're a surfer. Where do you live?
I live in Santa Monica now, but I'm from Malibu.
Wow. Do you have a surf in the moonlight?
Yes.
Now I know you're a real surfer from Malibu. Because you don't want to surf in Malibu while the sun is out because it's too damn crowded and everybody's screaming, my wave.
I just mentioned that because I know that you've talked about surfers a lot.
Yeah, I love to surf because it's really hard to describe, except it's a true metaphor for life. The nose of your board, Tom, is your future. The tail of your board is your past. And you stand in the middle. You live in the moment. Teaches you to live in the moment. Did you hear last week's show when I talked about Jerry Lopez and the Dalai Lama?
I heard a little bit of that, yes.
I'm going to play it again for those folks who haven't heard it. Hold on.
I would like to start with something from the Dalai Lama. You know, he was once asked what surprised him most about humanity, and he answered, man.
And this is what he says.
Because he sacrifices his health to make money. And then he sacrifices his money to recuperate his health. And he's so anxious about the future that he's not able to enjoy the present. The result being, he doesn't live in the present or the future. And he lives as if he's never going to die, and then dies having never really lived.
That's Jerry Lopez. Listen, Tom, hang on. Stay on the line because I got to take a break. I got to pay bills, and I'm coming back to talk to you. All right? So hold on.
Okay, great.
You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show here on ESPN LA 710. Talk about getting good at something and having a wonderful life. This is getting good at something, like really good at something. Carlos Santana and Michelle Branch. This is my desert island song. You can follow me on Twitter, at Dr. Robert Clapper. And I love talking to people on Twitter. All right, let's go back to Tom in Santa Monica.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Good. So I have an MRI. I have a torn labrum from the anterior to posterior, it says.
Of your shoulder, your hip?
Shoulder.
Shoulder, okay.
And I've gone to rehab a few times.
And how old are you again?
I'll be 52 in August.
So here's what's fascinating about a torn labrum. So first you need a clapper vision to know what the hell a labrum is.
Clapper vision.
The ball and socket of the shoulder. It's like a golf ball. Instead of the golf ball inside a coffee cup at Canner's Deli, that's what your hip joint is. The ball and the deep wall of the socket is a coffee cup. Your shoulder is the golf ball on top of the saucer of the coffee cup, not the coffee cup. It's flat. It's what allows you to have all that range of motion. So to keep the ball from dislocating, you need a rubber rim vertical around the saucer to keep the ball from falling off the socket. It's kind of looking at the Kings play hockey. The socket is the hockey rink, the ice, the boards that go around the hockey rink, that's your labrum. When you tear the labrum from 3 o'clock or 9 o'clock north to 12 o'clock, that's a superior labral tear, like Dwight Howard had, for example, and didn't need surgery. When you tear the labrum from 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock, the southern half, that's what Kevin Love had as Olenek ripped his shoulder out of the joint. He dislocated his shoulder. So the location of the labrum tear makes a difference, and the age of the patient. You're in your 50s. I don't think it's wise to put stitches in a labrum in a guy in his 50s because you tighten it up too much and they get pain. So if you're going to arthroscope someone's shoulder in their 50s for a torn labrum, that's superiorly, I like to, my opinion, to clean it up, to debride it, and they feel wonderful, I love that word, after that. So you always try to go to therapy first, Tom. If that fails, don't let them shoot you with cortisone or give you pills for it. Try therapy. If the therapy doesn't help and it persists, then you're entitled to get an arthroscopy of your shoulder. It needs to be done by someone good who knows what they're doing. And my vote would be to debride it, to clean it, not to put stitches in it. Okay?
Okay. Can I ask you one other question?
Yes, of course.
In the findings, because I've had surgery on the shoulder before for a different issue, the joint had to be cleaned up, the collarbone to the shoulder.
Yes.
Anyway, this says there is a metallic susceptibility artifact within the lateral deltoid muscular. What is that?
So I have to ask you a question. When they did your previous shoulder surgery, did they do it open or arthroscopic?
Arthroscopically.
So the reason the MRI, which is a magnet, is sensitive to metal. Guess what? The tools we use to do the arthroscopy, even though it's micro tools, they're hollow, and tools spin within the hollow tubes. It's a tube within a tube. That's what the tools, like a vacuum cleaner, that's what they look like that we use. Microscopically, as those metal tools that we use spin, shards of metal microscopically come off. And guess what can see it? The MRI. So it's not like they left anything. It's not like you have something to worry about. It just means you previously had an arthroscopy on that shoulder, and please don't worry about that. That is not causing your pain.
Okay.
All right?
So if the – okay. Well, that's great. So I'll keep going with the
– Go with therapy. You're 50. You have a very good chance of it getting better. Because it's a superior labrum, and this is a common thing that people have. And it may take 3 months. You know, learn the home exercises, do those as well. But if, you know, you make a line in the sand, what is it now? It's May. God, I can't believe it's May, too. If July comes, Tom, and this isn't better, okay, then of Seleucus, you're going to need to have an arthroscopy of your shoulder, okay?
So I'm not surfing this summer.
You could be. You could be. I'm not going to tell you the secret spot that I like to go to in Ventura, but you could be.
I know about all of them.
That's right, you know about them. Are you a longboard or a shortboard?
I do both.
You do both in your 50s. Listen, don't be a starker. Be a longboarder. It's enough already. You're in your 50s. Stop with the shortboarding. Your shoulder will feel a lot better. And you'll have to do what I do, Tom. You get the board made, and they put a handle in it. I had Walden. He made my last board up in Ventura. I had him make my board, and he put a handle in it so I don't have to, you know, I'm an old man now. I can carry my board because it has a handle inside. Do that, Tom. And thanks so much for listening. I very much appreciate you being a weekend warrior.
Thank you.
All right. I want you to find a total stranger today and do something nice for them. Okay, Tom?
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. All right, let's go to John in Pico Rivera. You're on with Dr. Clapper. How can I help?
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you, John? What do you do for a living?
I am in real estate management.
Nice. What did your dad do for a living?
My dad, God rest his soul, who passed about a year ago, was an insurance investigator.
Wow. And how about your grandfather?
My grandfather was in the Canadian military.
Really?
And pretty much spent his life doing that.
What part of Canada?
My dad was born in Montreal.
Wow. So they have something in Montreal that you can't get in the States. We can get corned beef and pastrami. But in Montreal, my friend Mason Weiss has taught me this, there's something called peppered beef. Have you ever had this?
I have not.
It's called peppered beef. I have no idea what it is, but if you meet people from Montreal, that's the first thing they want to talk about, to me, is this thing called peppered beef that's the better than pastrami or corned beef. One day I have to go back to Montreal and have this damn stuff, unless there's somebody here who can ship it here that we can taste it. That's all I think about when people tell me. I go right to the food, John. Isn't that crazy? That's all I think about.
That's okay.
It's okay.
Okay.
I guess it's okay. So, what did you do to yourself? How can I help you?
Well, I've throughout my amateur hockey career, I have had many certain knee surgeries. I'm 48 years old, and mm-hmm. I just had reconstructive knee surgery with cadaver, ligaments and all the good stuff about a year and a half ago.
I hate cadaver. I hate using the cadaver for the ACL, but go ahead.
Yeah, maybe that was part of the mistake. Year and a half later, I still have swelling. I still have stiffness and soreness.
Yep.
A lot better than it was before. but certainly not the way I had hoped, that's right. For certain.
Okay, so remember Carson Palmer, the quarterback?
I do.
Carson Palmer tore his ACL. They used an Achilles tendon allograft, a cadaver, to rebuild his ACL. 7 years later, nobody touched him. Nobody tackled him. He was backing up from behind the center, and his knee collapsed and had to have it redone using his own patella tendon. That's all I'm going to say to you, John. So I'm not suggesting you have any more surgery right now, and it's really an option. There's lots of reasons people prefer to do it, and sometimes you really don't have a choice. I have patients. They come to me. I want you to use a cadaver. Okay, I'll use a cadaver. It's easier for me as the surgeon. It's easier for the patient. But, you know, you got to look at the statistics of success rates, cadaver versus using your own body parts. There's a book I wrote with Linda Huey called Heal Your Knees. It'll give you an education, which you should have right now, about how to keep your knee in shape, what to do for it. If it's swollen and it's stiff, please don't let them shoot you with needles of stem cells and cortisone and other stuff. If it really is difficult, you know, and a year and a half is a long enough time for you to see where this is all going to head, and you probably have a PhD in physical therapy at this point. Do you ride a stationary bike?
No, but I do still try to play hockey, you know, pick up hockey with my now oldest son at a much lower level, but just to keep in shape and keep some movement in my body.
My advice to you would be to buy yourself an early birthday present of a Schwinn spinning bike, or go on Craigslist. You don't have to spend a lot of money. You don't have to spend a fortune for one of these newer stationary bikes, but you should own in your house, so that you can be in your pajamas and don't have to go to the gym and you're busy at work, that there's a stationary bike in the house and use it Monday, Wednesday, Friday for a half an hour. See that as a nurturing exercise so that you can go and enjoy yourself playing hockey. You will be the greatest therapist for your knee if you do this yourself. If it persists, though, in being problematic, then you should get a new MRI just to see what's cooking inside your knee.
Gotcha.
All right, young man.
That's why I call.
Well, thanks for listening to the show. You listen every Saturday?
Yeah, every Saturday. And if I have 2 seconds to tell you a quick story, my young 15-year-old boy who drives, I drive him to hockey every Saturday morning, can't wait for Dr. Clapper. He goes in late to practice sometimes in the morning and to pick up because he's got to hear what's going on with Dr. Clapper. And he loves the fact that you say, God bless at the end of every conversation with people. He just thinks it's incredible.